Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Maddie and Yusuf here. At CP Solvers, our mission is to make clinical reasoning accessible to learners worldwide. We invite you to join us for our live virtual morning reports, where we break down cases and sharpen our diagnostic reasoning together. Now over to you, Yusuf.
Thanks, Maddie. Just a quick reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice. Patient details have been modified to protect their privacy, and the views expressed here are our own, not those of our employers. Now, let's dive into the case.
Enjoy the show!
Hello, friends. This is the CP Solvers podcast. I'm David from Spain. I'm here today with Zachary, Justin, and Mariana. We're hearing today about a case from Austin. And yeah, we're just going to give a little bit update into our lives. I'm finishing my residency on July. I'm just trying to look for some jobs here in Spain, that we have some troubles finding when we finish the residency, but hopefully I'll find some place to work. And yeah, Zacharia, what about you?
Hi, everyone. Hi, David. Really excited to discuss the case today. I'm actually moving across country, and before the session, we were talking about how moving is probably the worst thing on this planet in many ways. But yeah, excited for it to be over and for new life and to be back in Cape Town, which is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Yeah, and passing it to Austin.
Thanks so much. Nothing really new or exciting for me. The weather is starting to warm up here, spending a bit more time outside and in the park with my two-year-old. But yeah, I'll pass it to Mariana to fill us in on how she's been doing.
Hello, everyone. I'm very glad to be here with you all today, and I'm very, very excited about this case. For me, no big changes. I'm approaching the end of my intern year. Time flew by really, really quickly. And I'm very excited about the next years. And Davida, what are you going to do? Are you going to be a house police?
Yes, I will try to. There are some difficulties regarding finding job when you finish the internship in Spain. But yeah, I like just generalist and differential diagnosis. So we'll try to stay as a house police. And yeah, Austin, let's start the case.
Absolutely. And I know you'll succeed in no matter what you do, but hopefully the job hunt goes smoothly. But to transition to the case, so for the first aliquot, this is a 60-year-old man who presents with elbow pain. Mariana, what do you think?
Very interesting. So elbow pain, I think I would start trying to gather more information about this patient and also about his symptoms. So I would ask about the onset and time course, because we want to know if the pain is acute or chronic, as acute pain raises concern for trauma or infection, while chronic pain is more often related to degenerative or overuse conditions, such as tendinopathies and osteoarthritis, for example. We can also think about the patient's age, because in a 60-year-old male, degenerative etiologies become much more likely, including OA and chronic tendinopathy, as I mentioned it. But we still have to think about infections and crystal arthropathies in our differentials, especially if the pain is located in the joint. I would also be curious about occupational and activity history. So it's important to assess for repetitive movement or overuse, which may suggest conditions like epicondylitis or olecranon bursitis, for example. So hobbies and recent changes in activity level are also very relevant. And I would say that the most important thing is actually associated symptoms. So I would ask about decreased range of motion. I would also ask about swelling, erythema, and warmth, where the pain is. I would be curious to know about ecchymosis and hematomas, about systemic symptoms such as fever, fatigue in the last few days. And depending on where this patient is, the history of tick exposure can be very, very relevant for Lyme disease, for example. And last but not least, I would ask about distribution and joint involvement. Because if the pain is in the joint, we want to know if it's unilateral or bilateral, because it's going to help us to differentiate and localize systemic conditions. The involvement of other joints may suggest a systemic rheumatologic process, for example. I'm curious to know what information you have gathered from this patient, Austin.
Wonderful, excellent start. So to answer some of your questions, the pain is only on the right side. The swelling started over the last few days. There is some pain related to the swelling, but it's localized to the elbow area and there's no radiation of the pain. There's no paresthesias, there's no erythema. Patient doesn't recall any history of trauma. They have no systemic symptoms. And at this moment in time, it's not really greatly impacting their functional status, fortunately. So David, how does this information help refine what you're thinking?
Yeah, thank you so much, Austin. This is not a...
This audio was created with async.com.
Yeah, thank you so much, Austin. This is not a chief complaint that I'm used to see, but I would frame this patient as a middle-aged male with unilateral, atraumatic, acute elbow pain and swelling. And as I'm not very comfortable with this chief complaint, I would prioritize the DDX according to the structures from more superficial to the deeper structures. So going first into the skin, I think the location here and the absence of erythema makes less likely the possibility of skin inflammatory diseases such as cellulitis or erysipela. Then regarding tendons and muscles, I think muscle injury would be rare here in the absence of any trauma or any specific exercise involving those muscles. Tendinopathy is a frequent complaint here, such as medial and lateral elbow tendinitis, especially if we happen to learn that the patient plays golf, tennis, or lifts weights, or has any occupational exposure. But I think here the swelling goes a little bit against this diagnosis. Regarding the vessels, the elbow is not a classic location for DVT and neither arterial thrombosis, especially in the absence of prior manipulation. I would be interested in knowing if there has been any prior lines in that extremity, especially distal to the elbow, or if the patient has had any AV fistula in that extremity. But the localization in the elbow, not the inner part of the arm or the forearm, makes this possibility less likely. Regarding the nerves, I think a compressive neuropathy and ulnar or radial neuropathy could be a possibility, but the absence of other more distal symptoms such as paresthesias or pain makes this possibility less likely. Lymphadenopathy could also be at play here, specifically epithrocleal lymphadenopathy, but I think this is pretty rare and is usually not painful. So yeah, we would have to keep in mind some infections such as hand and forearm infections or even syphilis that is classic to present with this epithrocleal lymphadenopathy. But yeah, it's not the best diagnosis that I have in mind. I think that most likely would be joint or periarticular structures. Any arthritis would be a possibility here, but I found the elbow as an unusual location for isolated monoarthritis. Gout or pseudogout could be a possibility, but we would have to know more about the patient's history. The first diagnosis here to exclude would be septic arthritis, but the absence of systemic symptoms or fever make hematogenous arthritis less likely, and the absence of trauma or any injuries in that region also goes against a continuity arthritis. There's also not severe limitation of range of motion, and that I think prioritizes, as Mariana said, periarticular involvement more than joint involvement. And in that sense, in that location, my main differential would be olecranon bursitis, and I think would fit with the pain and swelling. The only problem for me with this hypothesis is the absence of trauma, because in my mind, traumatic bursitis accounts for most of the cases. But I would wonder if there's any subtle injuries that the patient may have not noticed, such as leaning on the elbow or using it to arise from bed. We have to keep in mind also that olecranon bursitis can occur as a manifestation or gout or pseudo gout. So yeah, would wonder if this patient is at risk of these diseases. Finally, for bone pathology, I think this is less likely regarding the absence of trauma and the location. Fracture or dislocations are a possibility. I think bone tumors, meds, or stomalitis could also be a consideration here, but they are less likely given the absence of systemic symptoms. We would have to do an X-ray and maybe a more advanced imaging for ruling it out. In the end, we could also have elbow pain from ascending refer pain, either from a cervical radiculopathy or shoulder pathology such as a rotator cuff tendinopathy. But this seems unlikely given the swelling and the absence of other more proximal symptoms or paresthesias. Yeah, so I would be curious to know more about his history. Austin, what do you have for us?
All right, excellent distillation. So to give you some more background, so the patient's medical history includes osteoarthritis, hypertension, cirrhosis, which is felt secondary to alcohol, end-stage kidney disease on hemodialysis, that's felt to secondary to hepatorenal syndrome, and then chronic right upper extremity swelling, which is felt to be a sequela of a prior line placement during a hospitalization. Surgically, the patients had no major procedures. Family history-wise, there's not anything known by the patient, unfortunately. For the social history, the patient is retired and lives with their partner. They're never a smoker. They've never used substances. Previously, they drank alcohol heavily, but have not had any alcohol in the last 1 year. And current medications include hydroxyzine, which they take for chronic pruritus, and rifaximin. So, Zacharia, what are you thinking?
Thank you, Austin. And that's really fascinating. The past medical history honestly completely reframes this patient for me. We opened with a 60-year-old male, atraumatic elbow swelling that looks quite well, and that sounded...
This audio was created with async.com.
60-year-old male, atraumatic elbow swelling that looks quite well, and that sounded quite benign. But honestly, with this history, we have to recalibrate hard, and there's three threads that I'd like to pull on. First, this is an immunocompromised host. Cirrhosis brings with it associated immune dysfunction for many reasons. For example, portal hypertension induces bacterial gut translocation, and also hepatic dysfunction causes reduced synthesis of certain complement factors. The rifaximin in the past medical history tells me that this patient has had at least one bout of hepatic encephalopathy, and so that just further tells us that this patient has had decompensated cirrhosis at least in the past. And then when we layer on the end-stage renal disease, we're fully down the road of immunocompromise, with both this patient's innate and adaptive immune responses being blunted. So even if this patient has normal vitals, no fever, a normal white count, none of that really reassures me that this patient could have something serious brewing. Secondly, the patient has an arm itself that is compromised, and so we now layer on further structural immunodeficiency. The chronic right upper extremity edema from a prior line placement tells me that this patient's lymphatic and venous drainage on that side are impaired. And this is a well-recognized factor for stasis, cellulitis, and soft tissue infection. And then thirdly, crystal disease climbs higher up on the differential as patients with end-stage renal disease have chronic hyperuricemia and classically can have gout on the olecranon. So before anywhere we go exotic, this patient's gout in somebody with CKD who has a hot, swollen olecranon is an absolute no miss diagnosis. And so now I'm really, really curious. Has this patient had gout before? Are there any tophi on physical exam? And where exactly is his current dialysis access? Is it on the same arm or somewhere else? Furthermore, this patient's skin might have the effects of chronic uremia and cholestasis, making it dry and easy to crack. So even if this patient had minor trauma, that might actually end up being a potential source of entry for certain bacteria. So my framing has now shifted from probably atraumatic bursitis and nothing to really worry about, to an immunocompromised man with a chronically vulnerable limb. And I'm highly concerned that this could be septic bursitis, gouty bursitis, or potentially both, until proven otherwise. So really, really, really eager to hear more from Austin. Back to you.
All right, amazing distillation. So to give you their exam, so vitally, the patient's blood pressure is 125 or 75, their pulse is 80. They are afebrile with a temperature of 36.4 degrees Celsius. They're breathing 18 times per minute and sitting 99% on room air. Their BMI is 29. Generally, the patient's in no acute distress, but is chronically ill appearing. For the chest, the patient does have a tunneled hemodialysis line in place, and it's on the left side of the chest. For their extremity exam, the patient has 1+ pitting edema in the right arm with no erythema or ecchymosis. There's visible swelling posterior to the olecranon without any overlying skin changes. There's no crepitus or subcutaneous emphysema that was appreciated. And the patient has full range of motion of the right arm with intact sensation to the right arm as well. Radial pulse was 2+, and the cap refill was less than 2 seconds. So, Mariana, how does this information change your thought process?
This is very, very interesting. Thank you so much, Austin. So the fact that his vital signs are completely normal, he's afebrile, he's hemodynamically stable, this kind of lowers the likelihood of a systemic infectious process, but it still does not rule out, especially because this patient has cirrhosis and end-stage renal disease. And in the general appearance, he is described as chronically ill appearing, which is also not very helpful here because we can associate it all to his comorbidities. But there are a few things that are actually helpful. So in the extremity exam, he has 1+ pitting edema of the right arm, which we are told is chronic and related to prior line placement. So this is very important because the baseline asymmetry already exists and it can make new pathology harder to recognize. More interestingly, there is a visible swelling posterior to the olecranon without overlying skin changes. Swelling in this specific location immediately raises concern for a superficial process, rather than an intra-articular one. So things like fluid accumulation in the bursa are into consideration here. The fact that there is no erythema and ecchymosis is also important. So the absence of ecchymosis makes trauma less likely, but still not impossible. And the lack of erythema is not that helpful because it has poor sensitivity for both inflammatory and infectious conditions, especially early on or in an immunocompromised host as this patient. We were also told that there is no crepitus or subcutaneous emphysema, which is reassuring because it makes gas-forming infections or deep soft tissue involvement much less likely. And the fact that this patient has full range of motion argues against significant intra-articular pathology, like septic arthritis, where we would expect pain and restriction with movement. And the neurovascular exam is intact. There's normal sensation, a strong radial pulse, good capillary refill, so there is no concern for neurovascular compromise at this time. So my reasoning for the next steps would be, what types of conditions can cause fluid accumulation in the extra-articular elbow in a patient with liver and kidney disease?
This audio was created with async.com.
Articular elbow in a patient with liver and kidney disease. How can we better characterize this fluid? Is imaging sufficient, or do we need to perform an aspiration for fluid analysis? I'm curious to hear what you decided to do next, Austin.
All right, amazing distillation. So as far as the investigations, the patient had a basic metabolic panel, which was consistent with someone on hemodialysis. Liver tests were notable for a mildly elevated alkaline phosphatase at 165, the normal being less than 130, a total bilirubin of 3, and the rest of the liver tests were within normal limits. The CBC showed a white blood cell count of 5, hemoglobin of 9 with an MCV of 102 and platelets of 40. And all of these tests were at the patient's baseline. In ultrasound, looking for a DVT of the extremity was performed and returned negative. And then the patient also received an X-ray of the elbow. This showed that the bone mineralization was normal. There was no obvious fracture. Everything seemed to be aligned appropriately. There was no effusion. The joint spaces were largely maintained, but there was focal soft tissue swelling about the dorsal elbow, which the radiologist labeled as nonspecific, and enthesopathy of the distal triceps insertion was noted. So, David, what do you think of the investigations?
Yeah, thank you very much, Austin. Really interesting. I think I won't invest too much energy on anemia and thrombocytopenia because they seem to be chronic, and I think it's unlikely they are related to the current problem given the absence of systemic symptoms. For me, this looks like a problem pretty restricted to the elbow and particularly the olecranon. The increased alphos makes it interesting and raises the possibility of osteoblastic lesions. But given cirrhosis and increased bilirubin, I think it may be a red herring. Also, considering the X-ray is normal, I would wonder about the role of CT here, but I think it'd be useful to have prior labs to see if this is just a recent finding or has been present for a while. If the alphos was from bone origin, I would think this would represent more likely high bone turnover in the setting of secondary hyperparathyroidism, given the end-stage kidney disease, and I would like to know more about other bone parameters such as phosphate, calcium, and PTH. We've heard some pertinent negatives. We don't see any leukocytosis in the labs, and I think this lessens a little bit the possibility of infection, but we have to keep in mind that the patient is immunosuppressed, as Zachariah was detailing. The X-ray being normal makes bone pathology less likely, but I think its sensitivity is pretty limited for other structures. X-ray being normal, I think, would exclude extraskeletal calcifications, as can be seen sometimes in patients with CKD affecting bursas. The ultrasound being negative excludes DVT, and I think that's with confidence, given our pretest probability for this diagnosis was low. The swelling is not very well evaluated by the X-ray, and I would try to get an US or an MRI to confirm if there is bursitis or to look for other collections. Yeah, what do you have for Austin?
All right, so the way that things were synthesized at this point was that the patient was felt to have olecranon bursitis. They were given a course of antibiotics, which were cefalexin and doxycycline, as well as some prednisone. They were seen in our primary care clinic about 5 days later, and unfortunately, they had had no improvement at all despite the antibiotics and steroids. Exam at that time noted obvious swelling and warmth over the right olecranon with tenderness to palpation. And now the patient also had pain with extremes of range of motion as far as flexion and extension. Point of care ultrasound was done and showed that there was evidence of a fluid collection in that area, and it appeared complex with multiple internal hyperechoic signals. So, Zachariah, how does this information change your thought process?
Clinical problem solvers, huge shout out to our ongoing sponsor, Freed. Do you dread doing your notes day and night? Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 10,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. Start your free trial today. No credit card is needed, but use code CPS50 when you subscribe. Code CPS50 to get $50 off your first month. I love this resource. It is phenomenal.
Thank you, Austin. And a few things actually jump out to me. First, the combination of kefalexin plus doxycycline is absolutely...
This audio was created with async.com.
First, the combination of kefalexin plus doxycycline is absolutely reasonable outpatient cover for septic bursitis. So with the kefalexin, we're covering for our basic staph and strep. And then doxycycline adds on some atypical coverage. And depending on your local resistance patterns, potentially even MRSA. The prednisone may be controversial to some, but often in these situations, a really short course of prednisone is unlikely to worsen immunocompromise and will definitely effectively treat a crystal flare. However, if this patient is genuinely septic and who already has some dysfunctional immune system, then there is the possibility we could potentially worsen it. I would honestly have a considerate approach where I would start both and then carefully monitor the response over the next day or so with an extremely low threshold to change things if there is any worsening. And that's what we see. 5 days later, this patient has actually worsened. The physical exam is much worse and the bursa is showing features it didn't show on day one. So now we have to ask ourselves, why did empiric treatment fail? And a simple approach would be to break it down into three main buckets. One, could this be the wrong bug? We know we haven't covered certain gram-negatives as well as pseudomonas. And less likely, but definitely important to think about in this patient population is, could this be mycobacterial or fungal bursitis? Two, could this be the wrong diagnosis? If this were pure crystal bursitis, antibiotics wouldn't really harm anything, and the steroids definitely should have helped. And the fact that it's so much worse after a few days really, really argues against an isolated crystal flare. More importantly, even, is could this be non-infectious? We know this patient with uremia and hepatic dysfunction has coagulopathy for a variety of reasons. And could the fluid be not so much pus, but actually blood? Could this patient actually have hemorrhagic bursitis? And I'd be really, really interested to see what that fluid looked like when it came out. Thirdly, could this be the wrong diagnosis, but we actually haven't had a sufficient treatment strategy? And do we actually need to discuss with orthopedics about whether this patient needs source control and a full drainage? When we look at the ultrasound, we see that it's a complex collection. And this picture is honestly consistent potentially with pus. It could be hemorrhage. It could be crystal-laden material. And we can't really tell much more than that. So we'd have to aspirate. And when that fluid comes out, in addition to the standard cell count, gram stain, routine cultures, crystals, and so on, with his immunocompromised state, I'd potentially consider seriously asking for an AFB stain and fungal culture as well. So really, really interested to see what happened next. Back to you, Austin.
Ask and you shall receive. So we were able to arrange an appointment with orthopedics about an hour after our appointment. They were able to aspirate the olecranon bursa, and it was grossly bloody in appearance, with the studies confirming 800,000 red blood cells. The culture and gram stain and crystal evaluation all returned negative. And so the final diagnosis was actually a hemorrhagic olecranon bursitis, and the patient improved after aspiration with just some time and some local compression therapy to the area. So I thought this was a really fascinating case. It took us through a lot of different thought processes and schemas as far as how do we approach a joint pain? How do we approach monoarticular pain? Can we do an anatomical approach? Do we need to think about antibiotic failure? We need to think about the person's immune status. And so it really took us all over the place in a very short period of time. And fortunately for the patient, it ended up being one of the more benign diagnoses that we could have discovered. So, really, really excellent distillation. Any final reflections from any of you all?
Very, very interesting case, Austin. Yes, indeed, it was a pretty benign final diagnosis. But I think this patient in particular he required us to go through all of that because of his immunocompromised status. Sometimes we have to do further exams and investigate just to make sure be on the safe side, because a patient with cirrhosis and end-stage kidney disease, they could have pretty bad infections. And if we don't act promptly, we end up missing an opportunity to treat what is called in their problems.
Thank you so much, Austin, for the case. I didn't know about this specific diagnosis of hemorrhagic bursitis. I think this case brings many learnings, but the most important for me is what Zakaria said about having a very low threshold for investigating this patient that is immunocompromised and at risk of many complications given the cirrhosis and the end-stage kidney disease. And I think here, with a negative exam and negative labs, a simple tool as a POCUS can be of very help for getting into the diagnosis. So yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for bringing it, Austin.
Absolutely agree with everything that's been said. And thanks a lot for this really, really cool case. And I just think it really shows that even if you may not be comfortable with a certain presenting complaint, the power of analogic reasoning and seeing where things that you know from other sectors sort of fit into this problem, you can actually get quite far. So fascinating case, and learned so much. And pleasure discussing with you all.
Well, yes, amazing reflection. Thanks so much, everyone. And thanks, everyone, for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.
That's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to be part of our community, join us for our live virtual morning report, where you can present the case or discuss with us. Visit our website for details. We would love to have you.
This audio was created with async.com.